Okay, thank you for having me here. The title is a little bit more complicated, but it means more or less the same thing. So I'm going to talk about a paper that I wrote with some people from USC and a student in Rutgers. And it's about unoriented strings, loop equations, and n equals 1 superpotentials from matrix models. And the basic goal is to extend Dirac buffer to S, O, and P. So let me start with the outline. Well, first, I want to discuss what you expect from string theory as a prediction for the contribution due to unoriented diagrams to the superpotential. And once I've motivated what we expect from the matrix model calculation, I will introduce the matrix model conjecture by Dijkgraaf and Buffer, and do first a diagrammatic calculation to check whether at low orders in perturbation theory what we conjectured works. And then, since we didn't really find a proof how to prove it diagrammatically, we had to use something else, which is the loop equation, which I'm going to derive. And then I solve it to the first and second order, the second order being the non-oriented contributions. And then I even do a check for the non-perturbative parts, which come due to volumes of H groups and conclusions. So let me start off with the string theory construction. Well, we assume, like in Dijkgraaf buffer, that we have type 2B strings on a generalized conifold, which is given by something like that. And this geometry is singular at critical points of that W, which is going to turn out to be the tree-level superpotential. And we will assume that the W prime has only simple zeros to simplify analysis. And they are at positions xi in the x-plane. And, well, around each of those zeros of the W prime, it looks basically like a conifold geometry. And we now resolve this conifold geometry by doing a blow-up. Can everybody see it down there? So I basically introduce a P1, and it has to satisfy this equation in R4 cross P1. And in this geometry now, every singular point is replaced by a P1. That's all that's happening there. And next, we want to construct n equals 1 superangles by wrapping P5 frames around those P1s. So we distribute them over all the P1s. And important is that they are homologically equivalent. So I can, in principle, take one P5 frame and one P1 and bring it to another P1. That's basically the choice of vacuum for my SUN superangles. On the result side, there's only one P1, basically. They're all homologically equivalent, even though I have, you know, separated places. It's kind of weird to see, but you can basically make use of the vibration structure and then pull, basically, you have an A1 vibration over the base, and that has, the A1 always has a S2 in it, which is not holomorphic. So I can wrap that thing and then bring it to a critical point, but at the critical point, it doesn't shrink to zero anymore, but it's replaced by a P1. So I can basically use a vibration to.
I guess I might have naively thought if you pull something off of one singularity, it's hung up on more than one other singularity. So,
there it's just one. And this n equals 1 super young mills is a softly broken n equals 2 with a tree level superpotential which is given by the trace of W of phi. And a classical vacuum is basically where phi is a diagonal matrix, and all the diagonal elements are some critical points of the superpotential. In the gauge group, UN breaks down to a product of UNIs. Well, and now we need to produce a SO or SP gauge theory, and that we do by introducing an orientifold. And we basically want to construct an orientifold which fixes one P1, where we're gonna have a SO or SP gauge group, and then we have other P1s which are basically mapped to each other by the orientifold involution. And that can be done by basically taking the four coordinates in the generalized pony fold and send them to minus themselves, and then we leave the P1 fixed. And this involution is a symmetry of the geometry if our superpotential W is has only even powers. And so we assume from now on that it has even powers. And now there's going to be an orientifold 5 plane, basically at U equals V equals W equals X equals 0. And depending on the sign of the orientifold that I do, I get a SO or SP gauge group. From now on, I'll assume that I have SO gauge group because it's easier to think of SO groups than SP groups. Well, and now the gauge symmetry is broken from SON to SON0 times a product of UNs, where the UNs come basically from the critical points which are not fixed under the involution, and the Ns satisfy this relation. And in the infrared, this gauge theory is believed to undergo chiral symmetry breaking and confinement. And on the string theory side, this is realized by a geometric transition, where the resolved coney fold with D5 brains wrapped on them is replaced by a deformed coney fold, where I don't have the P1s anymore, but each P1 is replaced by an S3. And through the S3s, now I have fluxes, which are determined basically by how much Ramond-Ramond charge on the P1 has been. So the deformed conifold geometry is basically, again, the conifold equation, but now I add another polynomial, f of x, and this polynomial has basically as many coefficients as I have fixed points, and there are Ramond-Ramond fluxes. And in the x-plane, the picture is basically that I used to have the critical points of the W, and they now split up into two points, and between those two points I get basically I can connect them by a line, and there's an S2 fiber which shrinks to zero size at the end, so it's basically S3.
So is there a special S3 which corresponds to the S2 that was fixed under the involution?
Yeah, that's the one at the fixed point. And I have to enforce that the F here doesn't spoil the orientifold involution again. So it has only even powers again. So that's going to be that guy in the middle at the origin. But it's also going to split up, and I get an S3, which with the orientifold involution actually gets an RP3. And the superpotential can now have three kinds of contributions when I calculate it. It can come from closed strings in flux backgrounds. And we know that formula, which is basically integral of h wedge omega on the type 2b side. And then it can also have contributions from open strings, on which have to end on D brains, and that's described by holomorphic transignments theory in order to calculate the superpotential. And then there are contributions due to orientifold fixed planes. And now we need to basically look at the two sides of the geometric transition. They basically have to produce the same superpotential, and by comparing those two sides, I'm going to get the result that I expect. So From the resolved conifold sides, on that side we don't have any fluxes floating around, but we have deep rains and we have orientifold fixed plane. So the superpotential is calculated by strings where the world sheet has genus zero, but it can have arbitrary number of holes and can have up to one cross cap. Well, in the holomorphic transignment theory, this corresponds basically to planar and RP2 diagrams that I have to calculate. And on the closed string side, we have flux, but we don't have any open strings, and we don't have any orientifold fixed plane. So there are no contributions due to unoriented strings or open strings, and we can just use basically the flux superpotential to calculate the whole superpotential. And we just have to count how much flux on all the S3s is. So there's a special S3 at the origin, which has basically N0 over 2 units of flux and then minus 1 from the orientifold fixed plane. And all the other S3s just have NI units of flux. And the flux superpotential is then given by that formula, where this is basically the flux through the compact cycle times the period, and here as well, and those are fluxes through non-compact cycles, the dual cycles to the compact ones, and you get those. And this superpotential now has to agree with whatever we calculate on the open stream side. And on the open string side, we can also do a trick. We basically can calculate the contribution due to oriented open strings by saying we could have done the same thing without an orientifold, and we can use a geometric transition again, and we calculate that superpotential here. And now we can subtract those two to get the unoriented contribution. And we basically get the prediction that we need minus df0 by ds0 as the superpotential due to the flux, due to the orientifold plane. And I can reproduce this result from the matrix model now. So let me introduce the matrix model conjecture due to Dijkgraaf and Wappa. I won't give a very big review because it's already over half a year old. Just emphasize the main points. So basically, Dijkgraaf and Wappa conjectured that you can use a bosonic matrix integral to calculate the full superpotential of your gauge theory. And you basically need to do this matrix integral. You take the same tree-level superpotential, and you just integrate over whatever matrices you have, but they can have you assume different dimensions of those matrices than you have in the gauge theory. It's just some thing that I call M. And you can now expand this matrix integral in terms of diagrams. And the parameters in this expansion is G string and the coupling constants in the three-level superpotential. And then I have basically the number of Chanfaten factors which are on each vacuum, which I call MI. And I actually don't expand it in terms of MI, but in terms of SI, which I call G string times MI. And the genus expansion, I mean, it can be expanded in ribbon graphs, and the genus expansion is basically a G string expansion for the green. And I'm going to have to extract the planar and the RP2 diagrams. And then the superpotential, the effective one, is conjectured to be some non-perturbative part, and then n over 2 times df0 by ds0, and then n sum over ni df0 by dsi, and then I get a contribution from RP2 diagrams, and I put some constant in front of it, which has to be determined. And we're going to show that f1 is minus 1/4 df0 by ds0, and on the other hand, we had the prediction that actually we basically want minus 1 times dF0 by dS0 at the end of the superpotential here. So the constant has to be 4. And we were actually not able to produce that from the matrix model. The matrix model doesn't give you the factor of 4. It's something you have to put by hand. It was calculated in some paper by Beta, Nieder, and Voss, I think, in fall, right before our paper came out. And my theory about that is that basically the matrix integral calculates some string field theory for the topological string which lives in 6 dimensions. And the orientifold plane is actually a 2-dimensional object in that thing. But in the full string theory, it's a 10-dimensional theory, and my orientifold plane is some 6-dimensional object. So there are 4 extra dimensions, and the orientifold plane charge kind of gets some extra contributions. And you could explain a factor of 4 as 2 squared. But I'm not sure, I didn't really go very much into that. I don't know any better explanation except that you can do it in H theory and just get it. So let me start with the diagrammatic calculation. And basically we have to calculate ribbon graphs, and we are now allowed to use twisted propagators as well. And for SO gauge groups, each twisted propagator basically contributes a minus sign. And a diagram can then be evaluated by first drawing all the vertices and then connecting them by whatever twisted or untwisted propagators in such a way that it gives a certain topology, and I just count the number of ways I can do that. And basically each index loop contributes a factor of m. That diagram. And so planar diagrams are diagrams which I can, where I can draw the ribbon graph on a sphere. And then there's one slight subtlety that I can actually draw diagrams which have twisted propagators but which are planar diagrams. And the example here is basically if I connect two vertices only by twisted propagators, then I can just flip that thing over to the inside and it's a planar diagram. And if you really think about it very much, then you get that for, you get an extra factor of 2 to the number of vertices minus 1, because I can always flip one vertex over, and that gives me a bunch of twisted propagators in between that one and the rest. And that's of course only for connected planar diagrams. And then RP2 diagrams can be drawn on an RP2, and basically I drew the RP2 as kind of a crosscut. It's a, basically a disk, and the boundary is identified, the antipodal points are identified. And that's a typical RP2 diagram. But there are also RP2 diagrams which can have more than one twisted propagator. Confused us in the beginning a little bit. And on top of that, those diagrams, those planar diagrams with twisted propagators can basically now be drawn like that, where you push one or any number of vertices just through the boundary, and then it's kind of a disconnected diagram on the rest of the disk. And well, now we can just calculate a few of those diagrams. And basically, that's the simplest example with a one quartic vertex. And if you count the oriented diagrams, you basically have two ways to connect that thing. And since it's only one vertex, there's not an extra 2 to the number of vertices minus 1. And the unoriented diagrams, I get 4 of this because I have 4 ways to draw that ear basically on that vertex. And it's minus 4 because I have one twisted propagator. And then I have one like that, and I can do the check that if I sum up those diagrams, I get exactly the relation between the plane. push it even further. We wrote a little code, but by hand we can still calculate a diagram like that, or maybe with three vertices. But we didn't really find any good way to find the combinatoric proof of that statement except for just calculating diagrams. The good thing is that you can calculate those matrix theory diagrams much faster than field theory diagrams. So, since we failed to prove it diagrammatically, we now have to use some tricks, and that's a loop equation. Let me first derive the loop equation. Basically, loop equations are some word identities for reparametrization invariants of the matrix integral. So I'm gonna start off with that matrix integral, and I do a transformation of the phis, which is like that. Here I choose only the odd powers because I want to reproduce an anti-symmetric matrix again. And that can be expanded like that, and d phi is that, and one can calculate the Jacobian. And that's basically that thing. And there's a slight difference to the case of the SU n matrix model. Basically, I get a factor of 1/2 here, and that term is extra. Otherwise, I would get the same thing for the SU n matrix model. And basically, if I insert all of that into the matrix integral, I get this identity, which I can also write in terms of vacuum expectation values like that. And that's more or less a loop equation, which I'm now going to manipulate a little bit to get a better form. So let me first introduce what's called the resolvent. That's basically G string times trace of 1 over x minus phi. And if I now assume this form of the superpotential, a polynomial, and I introduce the coupling constants like that, and I introduce this operator, I can see that those quantities satisfy this, so I can get the omega, the resolvent, as a derivative of the free energy, plus some extra term, which is basically a pole that I introduced. And then one can see that also this identity here holds, that d by dv of x of the resolvent is that minus that, and that's trace square, and of that the def appeared actually in the loop equation that I wrote down before here. That guy. So I'm going to substitute that relation now in there. And the loop equation turns out to be that thing here, where I still have this funny object here, which I have to kind of manipulate to calculate easier with that, and for that I use some contour integration argument, and I convert this vef of this trace into a contour integral with a resolvent in there, where the resolvent basically picks out all the eigenvalues. That's how that comes about. And this integration contour is in such a way that it encloses basically all the real axis, but it doesn't enclose the point x, which is this guy here. So that's not in there. And now the loop equation can be written like that, and that's kind of a nasty equation, which is actually will be used as a recursion relation, some genus expansion. And in some cases you can solve it. So the first thing is this loop equation was first true for the full matrix integral. Of course, it's also true for the perturbative expansion of the matrix integral. And now I expand the resolvent basically in a genus expansion again, so in a G-string expansion, and I insert it into the loop equation and just take out all the powers. And the first two loop equations that I get are this for omega 0 and then this for omega 1. This is a quadratic equation. This is already a linear equation. But they are kind of complicated integral equations, and it's not always possible to solve them. For some cases you can. And once you calculated the omegas, you can calculate the free energy by using those relations. So let me first show how you would solve the loop equation for the first order loop equation. And I can only solve that for polynomials W. It's also possible for certain other W's, but for general W's it's hard to solve that. But basically what's happening is that this expression here, this contour integral simplified. Well, first we have a contour integral around C and we kind of pull it over to infinity. So we pick up this extra contribution here. And now this contour integral, if W prime is a polynomial, can be shown that this is basically a polynomial of order 2n minus 2 in x, where the constants are undetermined yet, but, or have to be determined, but that's not so difficult. And once we know that this is a polynomial, we can just basically write the loop equation like that, where we don't know what that is, but there are not too many constants in there. And we can solve that like that, this quadratic equation. And then in order to determine the constants, we basically know how many eigenvalues we have around each classical vacuum of my three-level superpotential. And this gives me exactly the right number of equations to determine the constants in F. So you basically have to solve those relations where this omega zero depends on F. That's not an easy problem. I don't know how well to do this. For cubic superpotentials, I think it's possible. Quartic. And now the free energy can be derived from this relation. And on top of that, there's another kind of special geometry relation that df0 by dsi is some integral. Basically, you take an eigenvalue from infinity to whatever cut your eigenvalue is sitting on, and you calculate the change in free energy semi-classically. And those two relations should determine f0. I don't know of any good quantum argument for the second relation, and I was also not really able to prove. I mean, those two equations together are some gradient equations for the F0, which is a function of the S and the G, and that those are go together, so that kind of there's no curl in that vector field. But that wasn't able to prove. But now comes basically the main point, which is the solution to the second order loop equation, which was that thing. And this is now a linear equation, which is inhomogeneous because of that term. And one can stare at the homogeneous part of the loop equation. And basically, if one compares it to the zeroth order equation, then it looks like it would be the derivative of the first order equation with respect to some whatever auxiliary parameter, which doesn't appear. Because if you differentiate that omega zero by some parameter, you basically get the first part. Um, So we can basically see that the solutions to the homogeneous part of that equation are just derivatives of omega zero with respect to some parameter, and the only parameters that we have are basically the choice of vacuum, which are the SI. So now we just have to find some solution to the inhomogeneous equation, and that now we do by basically knowing the results. So we had this conjecture that F1 should be more or less df0 by ds0, so we just make the ansatz and insert it into the equation. So from this we get, basically we can now say that omega 1 should be d by dv of F1. That's a relation that we know. And then we insert our ansatz for F1, so we insert that. And basically d by dv is some derivative with respect to the coupling constants. And that's a derivative with respect to the SI. And those two derivatives commute. So you can write it like that and insert what we know. We basically know what d by dv of F0 is. That's omega 0 minus S over x. And then we can take that derivative again, and we get that. And now we have to check whether that thing satisfies the loop equation. And the first part here obviously satisfies the loop equation because it's a homogeneous, it satisfies the homogeneous part of the loop equation. So we just have to show that the second part here satisfies the inhomogeneous loop equation. So maybe it's good to show the inhomogeneous loop equation again. Which is, can you see? So that's an inhomogeneous loop equation. So I have to show that 2q over x minus 2q over x satisfies that equation here. And the first part to look at is this integral here. So I take this integral and insert my minus 2q over x prime, and this basically takes out some residue, and it's basically w prime at zero, and since I have an even polynomial for w, this is zero. So now I just have to insert it into the second part. So I have to basically take omega zero times that thing minus 1 over 2x times omega 0, which I did here, and this is 0 if q is minus 1 quarter. So we see that we have a solution to the inhomogeneous equation, and one can actually see that there's more, basically by using the solutions to the homogeneous equation, one can show that there are more solutions to the inhomogeneous loop equation, which are of that form where the qk's sum up to minus 1 quarter. And we have now to argue that only q0 is basically minus 1 quarter, and the rest is the other q's vanish. Basically, the other possibilities, basically, the other cues that they are vanishing can be done by diagrammatics, for example. Because basically, if you have several gauge groups, you have to use a trick with the Fadeev-Popov ghosts, and you have several matrix models which are coupled by ghosts. You have an SO matrix model and then several UN matrix models. And the UN matrix models don't have any twisted propagators, and they don't have any RP2 diagrams really in them. So then it's easy to see that basically that only the Q0 is minus 1 quarter and the rest is 0. So that's about the perturbative part, and then the non-perturbative part comes of the superpotential comes basically from the volume of the group here. And so we have to analyze minus log of the volume of the group. And Oguri and Wafa, in one of their last papers, actually wrote down the volumes of the groups. And for SO2M, it was that expression. And if you insert that in here and expand it in powers of m, you get that expression, and you can take out the F0 and the F1 in this expansion. And they almost satisfy that relation again
with the relation.
Huh?
What is meant by the volume of the group?
Basically, you have to define some measure on the Lie algebra, and then by that you can calculate the group, the volume of the group. You have to basically choose a representation.
You have to normalize the metric.
There's a standard metric, right? It's Cartan-Killing metric.
You could even scale that.
It comes normalized somehow.
Well, you can also say that basically in the matrix integral you have to choose a metric on your Lie algebra, because we integrate over the Lie algebra, and that choice cancels exactly the choice that you have in the volume factor. But yeah, that's how you, and then you use some formulas which are derived by the guy, his name is McDonald, so some nasty calculation, which I wasn't really able to do very well. But basically what we get is that F1 non-perturbative is minus 1/2 df0 by ds0. But then we get this extra term, which we didn't expect. And we didn't have a real explanation, except that there might be maybe some mistake in the calculation. So all the parts, in basically it worked very nice for the log parts here. It's just some, basically this log 4 down here, it didn't work out very well. That could be some normalization problem on the maximal torus of the group. There's an extra factor of 2 somewhere floating around. But it basically works. Basically now I'm already at the conclusion. It's a little bit early. Sorry about that. So what we did was we now checked whatever this calculation by doing the n equals 1 star theory for the SO case, and we reproduced the result by Kummer and Trost from 2001. And well, of course it would be nice to have a more combinatorial proof of this relation, because it's kind of a long way around that we took. And it would also be interesting to see whether there's a relation between the loop equations in the matrix model and some relation that you would have in the topological closed string, like BCOV recursion relations. It doesn't really look like it's BCOV recursion relations, because we are a holomorphic anomaly, and all the loop equations look pretty holomorphic to us. There has to be something somehow.
Okay. If you take one over n corrections, it stores the omega prime term.
One over n corrections are basically G string corrections. I mean, I just did a kind of slightly different expansion. One over n expansion is basically a genus expansion in the matrix model, and I just shifted some parameters such that we get a G-string expansion.
But similar relations hold in full loop equations, not only permitted some 1 over n terms of sort of equations, right? The Singlish can't be the derivative.
Yeah, that's basically a 1 over the RP2 correction. The RP2 contributions are a 1 over n correction, basically.
Yeah, but even in SUN.
Yeah, in SUN, the first contribution would be from basically genus 1 diagrams, and those are gravitational corrections.
Yes. So gravitational corrections is in
you can calculate them in principle by the loop equations again.
And you expect that to be also related somehow to SUN?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think Uri and Bach are working on something like that. Higher genus corrections and gravitational corrections. I don't exactly know what the result is. But basically, you're expecting that you can use the loop equations to just generate all whatever all contributions, which would be all gravitational.